Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest, the Bay Area beacon of science. My name is Tucker Hyatt. It's still Tucker Hyatt. I'm the director of Wonderfest. It is my pleasure to introduce Sean B. Carroll, evolutionary biologist and author of The Serengeti Rules, The Quest to Discover How Life Works and Why It Matters. Dr. Carroll is the Alan Wilson Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics at the University of Wisconsin. He also leads the Department of Science Education at Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He is the recipient of the Benjamin Franklin Medal in Life Sciences, and he was named a Fellow of both the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Professor Carroll has received numerous awards, including the Stephen Jay Gould Prize from the Society for the Study of Evolution, and the Distinguished Service Award of the National Association of Biology Teachers. He's the author of several books, including Remarkable Creatures, which was a finalist for the 2009 National Book Award. He was the scientific consulting producer for the NOVA special that celebrated the 150th anniversary of Darwin's Origin of Species, which was based on his first two books, not the Origin of Species, but the NOVA program, based on his first two books, The Making of the Fittest and Endless Forms Most Beautiful. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Sean B. Carroll.
If you're confused, Sean and I know each other. This is the first time we're doing a doubleheader, of course, 6 weeks apart. We're gonna work it out sometime and show up at the same time in the same place, and no moderator will have a chance. So thank you, Tucker, for that nice introduction, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and to Wonderfest for hosting this event, and to Santa Clara. But especially thanks all of you for coming out on a beautiful Wednesday night to hear about the Serengeti Rules. My tales tonight begin on the Serengeti, and I'm going to give you a short talk, a little primer on some of the stories that are in the book, and then I'm going to sit down with Lisa Krieger from the San Jose Mercury News, and we're going to talk a little bit and field your questions. I first need to give you a frame, a little bit of the context. In the summer of 2014, I had just finished work on a documentary for the Smithsonian Channel on mass extinction, and in the course of that film, I had met a number of ecologists and gone to various parts of the world, and I was beginning to learn that even some of the most protected places on the planet were starting to have some issues, such as Yellowstone National Park. And like you, I had seen headlines like these, reporting that half the world's wildlife had disappeared in just the last half century or so, and even something like this, where it was being contemplated putting a paved highway through Serengeti National Park. And those headlines, that experience, prompted me to just begin worrying about some of these protected places, and just even for selfish reasons, wanting to see them in case they're no longer going to be the same. So in that summer of 2014, I took my family to the Serengeti. And here we are outside the incredibly fancy East Gate of Serengeti, just before our vehicle enters. And here's the view from outside the vehicle. So I was expecting, you know, sort of a grand entrance, but this is what it looks like. It's a gravel road coming into the Serengeti, and this is late June, and you can see the things look a little bit brown. The grass was fairly high and dry, and in fact, as we started working our way into the Serengeti, I started getting a little bit worried. We did see in the tall grass a lioness there. But I'm the only biologist in my clan, and I'm thinking, you know, we're here for 5 or 6 days. They're not going to want to do this, right? But as we drove further on, we started to see little streaks of green, a little bit of water, some acacia trees. And then as we kind of came over a rise and around a bend, it looked like this. We just started seeing massive numbers of animals. And in this case, zebra sort of in all 360 degrees, and maybe a couple thousand animals within our field of view. And then up on the horizon. This is home video footage, by the way. And then up on the horizon, a troop of elephants coming down to the watering hole. And from that moment on, you can see the zebra. From that moment on, the Serengeti offered up just an unending canvas of animals of all shapes, sizes, and colors, like, you know, sturdy warthogs and lounging hippos and sleek impala and majestic giraffes, my personal favorite. I never got tired of looking at giraffes. I would always make them stop the vehicle and go, I just want to watch. And then this little beauty gave us a private show for about a half a day. And as I gazed out on the landscape and at times tried to field questions from my family, I was awestruck. I was not, you know, I'm a professional biologist. I've read about this place. I've seen a lot of TV programs. So have you. But I was not ready for it. I was just awestruck, particularly by the sheer numbers of animals. But another sort of unsettling feeling came over me, which was I didn't understand what I was looking at. I'm an indoor biologist. I'm looking across the Serengeti, and there's this, you know, amazing pageant going on, but I didn't understand what I was looking at. And that's really embarrassing because I've spent about 3 decades studying the making and evolution of the animal kingdom, albeit indoors. And I've worked personally on the making of stripes and spots and creatures and how genes encode these patterns and how they evolve. And that just didn't seem right that I would know so much about the making of these creatures and nothing about what they were doing. And what I was really hung up on were the numbers. I'm sitting here in a biologist's paradise. I've had the good fortune to go around the world a lot, but I just didn't know what it meant to see, you know, tens of thousands of animals. And I didn't know why, for example, there were so many wildebeest, but really fewer topi, many fewer topi, which is an animal about the same size. And, you know, as I started to think about this and feel even more embarrassed, I thought, well, you know, what do I know? Well, one thing I do know is that everything in animal bodies and in our bodies is regulated. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that every substance, and there's probably 20 or 30,000 substances in your body, is maintained in a particular range. It's produced in particular amounts. That's whether that's, you know, every salt, every fat, every hormone, every enzyme, it's maintained in a particular range. And that's true of cell types in our body. White cells, red cells, kidney cells, liver cells, again, maintained in a particular range, produced in different numbers, but maintained in those particular ranges. So everything's regulated in our bodies, and I also know that over the last 50 years that we've really worked out a lot of the rules of regulation of how, in fact, things in our bodies are regulated. And the way that's worked out particularly is that we've focused on identifying, more of a sports term here in March Madness, the key players, the molecules that are involved in regulating a process. And we've figured out the rules that govern their play, the things they interact with, how many sort of links there are in a chain between some molecule and some outcome in the body. And that's led to a medical revolution because this molecular biology, what we've been doing for about 50 years, has transformed medicine because it's given us the knowledge to, for example, restore missing players. A good example of that would be insulin in the case of diabetes when the pancreas is not producing enough insulin. And this helped make a Bay Area company wealthy. For example, if regulation's not working properly, as in the case of heart disease and in cholesterol regulation, there are ways to intervene in the system in a very specific way to reduce unwanted quantities of things, things we're making too much of in this case, or have too much of in this case of cholesterol. So by understanding how things work, we can understand how to intervene. And we understand that things are very carefully regulated inside the body. So I just asked the question, what do we know about the regulation of things outside the body, like the number of bodies on a place like the savannah? So what I want to do tonight is just give you a little primer of the stories and things that are in the book. Some of the stories of medicine are actually in the book, but I want to know about how life works on a larger scale and ask the question, are there rules that govern what happens in the world on a larger scale? And if the answer was no, we'd be done and we could all go back out. But no, there are some rules. And then either in conversation with Lisa or from your questions, we'll talk a little bit about how these rules can and might be used to help preserve or even cure very sick ecosystems. So I'm going to start with a little Serengeti history that I thought you would find interesting. The emphasis for the moment is for my chat's going to be about the Serengeti, but I want to tell you right off the bat that these rules weren't discovered on the Serengeti. You can see them in play there, but they're rules generally discovered elsewhere, but they operate around the world. And that's what I want you to be thinking about, is that really every place in the world, from a blade of rice to your backyard pond to a forest or the plain, is a Serengeti. Okay. So I'm not the first biologist to be awestruck by the Serengeti. The Serengeti wasn't really seriously studied until starting in the late 1950s. The World Wars had people preoccupied. East Africa wasn't a big travel destination for a long time. But once biologists got there, one of the first things they did was they wanted to count the animals. And the first count was done by a German father-son team called the Jimmicks. And here's how they did it. This is from a film called Serengeti Shall Not Die. This is the father of 17, Bernard and Michael. This is their very handsome plane. And they and two other spotters climb into this plane, and they're going to fly over the whole Serengeti ecosystem, and by eye, they are going to count these animals. So let me give you a sense. Oh, here's graphics, circa 1959, a little pre-George Lucas. That's what they did. They flew back and forth in grids across the Serengeti. And here's what it looks like out their windows when they're doing that flying. This is flying low and slow, counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, wildebeest. Okay? So they do this in a grid day after day. And as you can see how low they're flying, and they have to, you know, maintain these grids. And they're counting not just wildebeest, which you're seeing a lot in this footage, but every large mammal that's visible from the air that they can. And they were very impressed with what they saw. Let me give you the numbers. From January 1958, they counted 99,481 wildebeest. Not one more, not one less. With Teutonic precision, they reported 57,199 zebra, 5,000 topi or so, 1,800 buffalo, only 60 elephants. The elephant population was still pretty scarce in the Serengeti at the time. That was a hangover from the ivory trade in the 19th and early 20th century. But 366,980 large mammals in total. And they admitted that maybe they might have missed about 10,000 in the course of their work. But in their book of the same title, Serengeti Shall Not Die, they expressed this concern. Were there enough plains, mountains, river valleys, and bush areas to maintain the last giant herds still in existence? This is a special place. These large herds, in fact, the large migrating herds, still in existence. Well, an answer to this question would soon materialize, but it wasn't the answer they expected or really the one they feared. In the mid-1960s, just a few years later, when this Oxford undergraduate arrived in the Serengeti to study it, big changes were taking place in the Serengeti, unbeknownst and unexpected by anyone. Tony Sinclair was an Oxford senior when he arrived to study birds, but he participated in this aerial survey that eventually became an annual survey. And compared with 1961 records, something was going on in the Serengeti. And when they counted the buffalo, buffalo numbers had changed fairly considerably in the Serengeti, from 16,000 to 37,000. And they asked Tony, would he like to come back and study his doctorate in the Serengeti, and not birds, but we like to study buffalo. And he said, sure, I'll do that. So what he did over about the next dozen years is he asked a few general questions. And this is, I believe this is a tranquilized animal. I think Tony's a very responsible scientist. This is not how you would study an alert buffalo. So the question he was asking was, why were the buffalo increasing? And what explained the great differences in the numbers of different kinds of animals? And fundamentally, what Tony wanted to understand is, why is the Serengeti the way it is? So he probed this buffalo mystery, continuing with these surveys, It turns out that the population truly was growing. It kept growing through the 1960s and early in the 1970s. Yeah, it was almost a fourfold increase over a little more than a decade. So what could be going on? Well, Tony, like all science, is basically detective work. So he started thinking, well, what could be the cause of this? And you could think of these possibilities yourself right now. Common sense. You got more animals? Maybe. There's more food. But when you look around the Serengeti and you look at all of the lands of the Serengeti and the forage that's available, all the grasses, there was no evidence that there had been really any change in the amount of food available in the Serengeti. So he said, no, that wouldn't be it. Okay, if the amount of food's roughly the same, well, maybe they're not getting eaten as much. Maybe there's fewer predators. But Tony made a careful study of the buffalo, and it turns out buffalo, first of all, aren't taken by predators that often. Yeah, you've seen it on TV, but it's not their major cause of mortality. And second of all, not only were there not fewer predators, those same counts were revealing the number of predators was creeping up. So that didn't explain it. So what else could explain a boom in the wildebeest? Well, the other thing that might be limiting the wildebeest prior to this time could have been disease. And a good number of diseases were known in wildlife, and one in particular stood out to Tony Sinclair. And it's called cattle plague or rinderpest, and it had been well documented in the Serengeti over the previous 60 or 70 years. Periodic outbreaks would happen and devastate wildebeest and buffalo and cattle. And it was the cattle everyone was concerned about, because either surrounding cattle ranches or the Maasai cattle would suffer terribly. And, you know, here's a horrific picture from the early part of the 20th century. So these outbreaks happened regularly, and it was believed that the wildlife was the reservoir for this virus, right? So those wild animals were causing problems for cattle. By the early 1960s, a vaccine had been developed for rinderpest, and a vaccination program begun in East Africa to vaccinate the domesticated cattle. So Tony thought, well, if maybe that vaccination program is having some spillover effect on the buffalo, let's see whether or not there's some relationship between what buffalo have been exposed to and buffalo populations. Now, if an animal or you or I are exposed to a virus, you make antibodies, and that's a sign that you've been exposed. So Tony got blood samples from a lot of buffalo and age-matched them and found out that, in fact, he couldn't detect antibodies to rinderpest in any animals born after 1964. So that the fraction of animals dropped to zero that had any exposure to rinderpest. So rinderpest was disappearing from the buffalo population by the mid-1960s. So this is his first eureka moment. This looks like a pretty good explanation for why the buffalo are booming. But Tony also knew that one of the other species, as I mentioned, most affected by rinderpest is the wildebeest. And so he started paying more attention to the wildebeest, participating in their counts. Let me show you what happened to the wildebeest over this time period. I like you guys. Whoa. Never thought a table would be that interesting, huh? Yeah. 1.4 million. So the Jimmicks were worried that, you know, could the Serengeti hold all these animals? Little did they know there'd be more than a million more a decade later, right? A decade and a half later. So the wildebeest were booming. Tony did the same study in the wildebeest. He got blood samples from the wildebeest. He age matched them with the animals and said, what's going on here? Essentially, superimposable pattern of the buffalo. In fact, he couldn't find any exposures to the virus in animals born after 1963. So the virus was disappearing from the Serengeti. Not only was this good news, but of course, the shocking part for some people was the vaccination program was in the cattle. So the wildlife was not a reservoir for the virus. The virus was in the cattle, and once you vaccinated the cattle, there was a spillover benefit to all the wildlife, at least the wildlife that was vulnerable, and that was the buffalo and the wildebeest. Now, you had a million more animals on the Serengeti, big animals like the buffalo, a pretty good-sized animal like the wildebeest. And Tony and others who were spending year after year in the Serengeti, they noticed other changes taking place on the Serengeti during this time period. And let me just give you a few of those observations and let you kind of stir on them a little bit and see whether we can make sense of them. One of the things that happens in the Serengeti every year is fire. And a careful study of the amount of the Serengeti, different parts of the Serengeti burned every year revealed that in different sectors of the park, much less burning was taking place, and those fires were less intense. Okay, so fewer and less intense fires. There are also more giraffes, which is just a lovely thing. Okay, and it was visible if you looked sort of low to the ground at saplings, but this really became clear over the decades that there were more trees in the Serengeti. This is a picture taken from the same vantage point over three decades. You see this smattering of acacia. There's actually a little bit more in 1986, but they're mostly younger trees filling in a little bit. And then you can see later, those are all nice mature acacia. So there's actually more tree growth going on during this time in the Serengeti. So let's see if we can connect the dots here a little bit. Here's how you might connect them. So you eradicate this virus because it's something you do in cattle. And this virus has been suppressing animal populations, wildebeest populations. So once that's eradicated, you get more wildebeest. Well, what do wildebeest do? They eat grass. So there's more wildebeest, so they're eating more of the grass. So you now have less and shorter grass. In fact, the grass on average goes from about 30 centimeters high, to about 10 centimeters high. With less grass, you have fewer and less intense fires. And one thing fire does is it destroys saplings. So with less fire, you got more trees. And with more trees, you got more food for giraffes up there in the acacia. So this removing this virus from the Serengeti had this whole domino effect mediated via the wildebeest that not only influenced the wildebeest and buffalo, but influenced tree growth and giraffes. And as it turns out, this extra tree growth provides cover for predators, it provides habitat for birds, and the shorter grass, for example, provides more habitat for other types of plants, as well as butterflies. So there's all sorts of rippling effects of the wildebeest. So through by making these connections over a couple decades, what Tony realized is, you know, what makes the Serengeti the way it is? It's a million lawnmowers. That mundane act of a wildebeest munching on grass, multiplied by a million times as they make a 600-mile circuit around the Serengeti, sets up this whole landscape for all these other creatures. Now, this is not the story that I've learned from TV, no matter how many programs, right? If it says Serengeti, I guarantee you they're going to show a cat chasing an animal and some blood and guts, okay? They're not going to show you a nice half-hour scene of wildebeest munching grass, okay? And I'm just as guilty because when I asked my family for pictures so I could come give a presentation like this, we got zebras, we got giraffes, we got lions, we got cheetahs, we got leopards. I got almost no wildebeest pictures, right? They're everywhere. You ignore them. They kind of, you know, they're kind of homely and they seem kind of dumb, but they're what make the system. So biologists have coined a term for an animal that has such an important influence on the whole ecosystem. And I'm going to give you three Serengeti rules tonight, which is a bargain because there's six in the book, which if you buy it, you'll have to decide whether it's a bargain or not. And this comes a little bit from George Orwell, that some animals are more equal than others. There's lots of animals out there in the world, but some have a disproportionate influence on the diversity of communities, and they're called keystone species. Now, this was not discovered in the Serengeti. This was coined, in fact, by a University of Washington zoologist named Bob Payne, who was working on the intertidal system of the Pacific coast, and particularly these starfish that may be familiar to you along the Pacific coast, Pisaster ochraceus. This is a predator that has shaped the structure of the community along the intertidal zone. And this rather frenetic animation over here is just showing you where he got the idea, which is out of Roman architecture, the idea that the last stone, the keystone in a Roman arch is essential for supporting the two columns, and without it, the columns collapse. And the same idea was a keystone in an ecological community is necessary or the community collapses. Payne, a pioneering ecologist, also coined another really important term for this sort of relationship, these sort of cascading effects through creatures that operate at different levels in the food chain, what are called trophic levels, predators, herbivores, plants, etc. He called this a trophic cascade, and that's the second look at this, they're coming fast and furious now. And that's really the second Serengeti rule that I want to share with you. And the idea is that some species have strong indirect effects on other species through trophic cascades. And those indirect effects mean also they were generally very surprising effects to the biologists and ecologists who discovered them. You wouldn't walk onto the Serengeti and say, I think these wildebeests are a really good thing for the giraffes, right? It takes a long time to figure out that these things are connected. And some of those trophic cascades, some of those indirect effects are really surprising, and maybe we'll talk about some that operate really nearby to here that, in fact, they're really how trophic cascades were discovered. Hint, Monterey Bay. Okay, so just to wrap up and give you one more rule, you might now be wondering, some species are more important than others. Some have strong indirect effects on others. The wildebeest are booming. Did they just keep right on growing? I mean, how many wildebeest are there in the Serengeti right now? Well, if they kept up that pace, I think Africa would be solid wildebeest by now. That's not what happened. What happened was they actually leveled off at about 1 million animals. Okay? So they overshot a little bit. And I want you to just puzzle for a little bit. How would you regulate something like the wildebeest? Or what would be regulating these wildebeests such that they would boom and then kind of level off, if not sort of go through a little bit of a mini crash? And it's important to unpack this just for a second, because it's really important about how other creatures grow on the planet. So what could regulate the wildebeest? So let's think of a couple possibilities. It could be food, what we would call sort of bottom-up regulation, or it could be predators from the top down. They're taking the animals. So before I tell you what's going on with the wildebeest, let me tell you in general what's going on in the Serengeti. It's one of my favorite graphs. I say graphs, here it comes. But I think there's just so much information here. If I'd seen this graph before I'd go into the Serengeti, or I'd say this, they should put this graph in every little tourist brochure, because you'll understand a little bit more of what you're looking at. So it turns out that Tony Sinclair and a bunch of colleagues have actually studied what happens to animals on the wildebeest, animals on the Serengeti, their causes of mortality. And some mammals are regulated by predation and some by food. And here's a graph plotting body size against percent predation. Now look up here at the little Oribe, about a 15-kilogram animal, and the impala and topi. Isn't life interesting for them? What bedtime stories do they tell their children? Someday, you'll be eaten. 100% taken by predation. And for the Oribe at the smallest, that's not just the cats. There's about 10 predators. That includes large snakes and hawks and things that take out Oribe. But as you get a little bit bigger, the rate of predation goes down. You get very big. Look over here at the right. Elephants, hippopotamus, rhinoceros, virtually no predation. So animals here on the right have gotten so big that they have escaped control by predation. But of course, they're so big, they require a lot of food. So they're food regulated. They're very dependent upon the food supply, while these guys are predator regulated. These guys reproduce slowly. These guys had better reproduce quickly, or they go extinct. So this is the curve. And where do wildebeests fall on this curve? Well, it turns out that wildebeests are generally food regulated. And how does that work? Well, it works according to their density. All right, so picture this. It kind of works like a feedback mechanism. When there's lots of food, as there was when the rinderpest was around, and small numbers of animals, the animals are at low density, they can grow really quickly. A high growth rate, virtually a maximal growth rate, as fast as they can reproduce. But as their numbers go up, okay, so they're growing quickly when food per capita is plentiful, but as their numbers go up, there's less food per capita, particularly in like the dry season. And what happens is growth declines, actually can turn negative. Population can shrink when food is limiting. And so the wildebeest sort of overshot the mark, and then they've leveled off at about 1 million animals. The reason I tell you this is that this part of the curve is really important for sort of the way humans manage the world, because it's the ability of animals to grow rapidly when resources are still around that we're really dependent upon in restocking all sorts of creatures we may have a chance to talk about. So I told you these stories from the Serengeti because I wanted you to understand that the regulation of species is not always by predators. It can be dependent on food and can depend upon their density. There's your third Serengeti rule, and this rule is really important for a lot of species on this planet. But I also told you this rule with these rules with these storybook animals because I want you to have in your mind that really every place is a Serengeti at every ecological scale. with predators and herbivores and producers, and that for us to understand how these systems work, and because our demands on nature are so great, and she supplies us with everything that we need to understand that to intervene in ecosystems, we got to understand the rules of regulation in these systems. We need to understand the key players that regulate community structure. We need to figure out the rules that govern their play. And if need be, we need to replace what's missing or fix the broken links. So I'm going to stop there and invite Lisa, who's... There she is. Oh, sorry, I thought you were Lisa right there in the front row. We got her from the ice. Please welcome Lisa Krieger from the San Jose Mercury News, and we'll chat a little bit.
Thank you.
And hopefully after that, it's still Wednesday night. Okay.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Carroll. Can everyone hear me?
And you can kill
great.
The slides if you want.
Yeah, thank you. I have to say the book is just as engaging as Dr. Carroll is in person, and really recommend it. Some lovely stories that he tells about individuals, and then makes these fairly arcane things really come to life, both in medicine and in ecology. I love that the drama of the Serengeti is a virus. It's not this beautiful, iconic predator. Really interesting point. You mentioned in your book that you called it the Serengeti rules, but it could be the Lake Erie rules. It could be the Monterey Bay rules. Talk a little, if you could, about that very elegant system where a predator controls a species that it actually doesn't predate. It's several,
right.
It's removed.
So this is on display in Monterey Bay, and this was discovered by Jim Estes at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and John Palmisano for the University of Washington. And the work was actually inspired by Bob Payne. Estes was a graduate student. He wanted to study sea otters. He was up in the Aleutian Islands, I think on some Department of Defense project. I think they were going to blow up. They were going to set off underwater detonations to create bays up in the Aleutians. And they were wondering, what will this do to the animals?
Wow.
Well, it could hurt their hearing. That's for one thing. So he was up there to study sea otters. And Bob Payne happened to be there at the same time for different reasons. And Estes mustered the courage to tell Bob what he was going to do. And he said, I'd like to see how the kelp forest supports these otters. And Bob says, Jim, you got it all upside down. You want to know how the otters influence the kelp forest. And he's like, all right, how am I going to do that? And what he did is he went to different islands in the Aleutians, some of which had otters because they had recovered in some places after being virtually decimated at the beginning of the last century, and some places did not. And when Amchicka, where he started, had otters, it had beautiful kelp forest, and the urchins were all small. When he went to Shimya Island, where there were no otters, he said that the greatest amount of learning in his life happened in 1 second when he put his face under the water at Shimya and saw no kelp and just a carpet of gigantic sea urchins. And he said, any fool could have figured it out, that what was happening was the sea otters controlled the urchin populations, mm-hmm. and the urchins grazed on the kelp. And with no otters were there, the urchins just grazed the kelp to nothing, and there was no kelp forest. But with otters, the predators there controlling the urchins, the kelp forest flourished. And that kelp forest, just like any other forest, provides habitat for all sorts of creatures, for fish, for other invertebrates. Those fish are fished upon by bald eagles and seabirds and all that sort of thing. So there's a lot more diversity in a kelp forest, kelp-forested bay than there is when there's no kelp forest there at all. And so that's a trophic cascade. That's the sea otter acting as a keystone species that by controlling the urchins, it's indirectly controlling the kelp, and that's indirectly have this huge ripple effect on all the other creatures. And this turned ecology upside down because in the 1960s and decades before, the thought was that really life was regulated from the bottom up, that plants gathered sunlight and turned that into food, and grazers worked on that food, and if there were enough grazers around, there might be some predators that fed on those grazers. And that kind of thought, like predators were sort of like ornaments on a Christmas tree, not the idea that the predators were actually forcing the system from the top down. So those really surprising, not intuitive, counter to the way we thought sort of discoveries really started changing the way we looked at nature. And these ideas are fairly recent, and they've taken a while to sort of, permeate biological thinking.
And your book references wolves as well, and describe the impact there.
Yeah, so you might say, and some of you in the audience may know this story, that even though this was sort of worked out for the Pacific coast with things like sea otters, once wolves were listed as an endangered species, there was an obligation of the federal government to do something about it. And then this argument started in the 1970s of what to do about wolves in North America, and particularly in Yellowstone. And it wasn't until 1995 that wolves were finally reintroduced into Yellowstone. Well, by that time, some sharp-eyed botanists had noticed that the vegetation in Yellowstone was a little weird. There had been very little new aspen growth for 70 years. I mean, aspen, these iconic trees of the American West, very little growth. What's going on? Well, the dots all sort of connected pretty soon, because as the wolves started to control elk numbers, aspen started to rebound. Not only aspen, cottonwood along riverbanks, willows around riverbanks. Plants are growing. And what's the collateral?
And the rivers are healthier.
And the rivers are healthier because, in fact, what's happening is that as the willow there is actually prime beaver habitat, the beavers come in. There was only one beaver colony in all of Yellowstone prior to the wolf reintroduction. There's somewhere between 9 and 12 right now. And what's happened is with that willow regrowth, that's habitat for beaver. They dam along the stream banks, create these little, mini habitats that are important for other sorts of animals. So what's really happened is that the wolves, by controlling the browsing activity of elk, have had these major effects on the vegetation in Yellowstone. So this sort of thing is going on in all sorts of places, but it's these strong indirect effects that, if you don't know about them, sometimes you learn about them for the wrong reasons. Certainly in fisheries and in shell fisheries, we've learned some things that maybe we should have known, but we don't learn them until
kind of late. I'll jump in there, because I assume your example, the Monterey Bay, is sardines.
I don't know the story of sardines, so maybe you can help me with that one.
World War II, they were sent overseas, the populations plummeted, and it had a cascade effect as well.
So I didn't know that one, because the other effect of each world war in the North Sea, because of all the submarine activity, for example, in World War II, was that all the big predators rebounded in the seas. So, you got to thank the U-boats for the recovery of North Atlantic cod and things like this, at least for a while.
So, speaking of starfish, they've been very much in the headlines recently here because of a virus, which you all have probably heard about. Any crystal ball as to what may happen there?
I don't understand what happened. I think people are still working on it. And if anybody in the audience knows more, speak up. But, these epidemics break out. I don't know the source of it. Could it have been a problem with pollution? What are all the complicating factors?
Virus,
yeah,
think,
it is a virus.
Right.
But why are they vulnerable? They could have been weakened for other reasons. But here would be my hope, because having met these starfish, I'm kind of fond of them. They've played a huge role in ecology, and they play an important role in regulating the intertidal community. Is that even if they're knocked back pretty far, that there should be resistant individuals. And those resistant individuals produce a lot of young, and there's a lot of habitat and a lot of food there. And I hope it's sort of a story, much like sea otters, which were knocked back to 1,000 animals across the entire Pacific. They're knocked back to about 1,000 at the turn of the last century and rebounded to about 100, 150,000 animals, within a century. Elephant seals, northern elephant seals, knocked down to about 20 individuals in the late 1800s. 200,000 today. So we certainly, and there's many, I'll be happy to tick off more cases, but given a chance, nature's incredibly resilient. And in this case, hopefully the starfish will rebound. We'll be worried for a decade or however long it lasts, but hopefully we'll start seeing them come back, and the ones that come back will hopefully be, more robust to the virus.
And then if we want to intervene and help restore an ecosystem, it sounds as though whether we supply from the top or the bottom depends a lot on the species that are there or the strategy. Talk about what you saw in Mozambique, which is a great story.
You can take from the endangered species stories some a lot of heart. I mean, just in the last couple months, the Florida manatee is proposed to be delisted. Its population has quintupled since it was protected about 40 years ago. Grizzly bears and Yellowstones have quintupled, and they're thinking of taking it off the endangered species list. It would still have some protections. It's not open season on grizzlies, I hope. It just means that they've reached a certain level where it's not as an acute danger. So you think, that's one species at a time. But what if a place has really just been devastated? And the story I tell in the book, and the last place I went to for the writing of the book, so this book was born in the Serengeti and finished in a place called Gorongosa in Mozambique in southeastern Africa. So Mozambique is an enormous country. It's twice the area of California, has a 1,000-mile-long coastline, but a tragic recent history. So after independence from Portugal in the mid-70s, a civil war broke out. It lasted almost 20 years, killed 1 million people, displaced probably 5 million more. And really, one of the main sites for that civil war was Gorongosa National Park, which was a jewel in the center of the country, really the geographic center of the country. In the 1960s, this was a tourist destination for the jet setters. You know, John Wayne and Hollywood stars and things like that went because there was an incredible concentration of big game. Lion, and not when I say big game, big animals. It was not a hunting place. Lions, elephants, hippo, buffalo. So like 14,000 buffalo, 500 lions, etc. After 20 years of civil war, there were no lions detectable. 14,000 buffalo were down to 50. 3,000 hippo were down to fewer than 50. So by the year 2000, what used to be tens of thousands of animals, large animals, there were fewer than 1,000 altogether. Antelope, zebra, water buck, all combined, fewer than 1,000. Greg Carr was an American philanthropist who made money by selling a telecommunications company he founded, was looking for a project to really sink his teeth into, learned about Mozambique, learned about Gorongosa, started learning about conservation, and he thought this, the rebound of this park could be an engine for human development in Mozambique. And so he committed a substantial amount of his personal wealth to trying to rebuild Gorongosa and invited the world scientific community to come help. And that really launched in 2004 from an absolute baseline. I mean, all the buildings were shot to heck. There were no tourists. Greg slept in the back of a pickup truck to start the project. So I went there last summer, 2015, and sat in a room as the latest aerial survey results were discussed. And the now total of animals in Gorongosa is 71,000.
Yeah.
11 years.
So
that's what I mean
by
nature given a chance.
Yeah, how did he accomplish that? Did he introduce species from the top, the bottom?
A little bit. So he feared that he was going to... So he started by shipping in some buffalo from South Africa. Mm-hmm. But this is expensive. It's logistically difficult to do large numbers. You got to imagine, how do you ship 200 buffalo? I mean, that's a lot of trucks. And it's stressful on the animals. And he thought he was going to have to ship in animals every week. But he started to learn that, in fact, the most important thing was protection. And so he built a ranger force, and so poaching was curtailed, never stopped, just curtailed. And the numbers just started booming because the whole habitat is there. It's a magnificent place. It gets a lot of rain in the wet season, and then water runs off. There's a mountain in the center of Gorongosa, Mount Gorongosa, and there's a sort of a big bowl that's sort of like a salad bowl for the animals to all come out and feed. And just protecting those populations was really the key. So he brought in, I mean, just a handful of elephants, a handful of hippos.
And it
mix up the genetic backgrounds of the animals because they were down to such small numbers.
It achieved its own balance and its own regulation?
I think we're looking at the early stage. So they're in the boom phase. So some antelope populations are doubling every 3 years.
Wow.
So they're in the steep part of the phase. And what's tricky about this is that different animals are starting from different baselines.
Right.
So there were probably more water buck left than anything. There is now a lot of water buck in Gorongosa. But the zebra are still scarce. Lions were virtually absent. There's 63 there now. But 63 is not a lot. And lion prides, they are rivals with each other. That's still a small number in terms of genetic diversity. Each population is kind of at a different stage. The water buck are probably past 100%. Well, they are past 100% of where you need them. Elephants are on their way. I saw herds of elephants where probably half the elephants were youngsters. So different animals reproduce at different rates, and they started from different numbers. So you're sort of mid-rebound, and what this is going to look like 5, 10, or 20 years from now is a little hard to know.
What a great research project.
It is. So it's drawing ecologists from all over the world to do this, and it's a magnificent work. And if you want to learn more, if this interests you, and I know it sounds like I'm touting, but look, this was a life-changing experience for me in terms of kind of rebuilding my faith in the world, was A small number of people and really a modest amount of money is having dramatic effects. It's a cool place to go on safari. If you're just interested online, go to Gorongosa. Just look it up online. You can learn more about the park. There's even a citizen science project that through my organization, Howard Hughes, we have going. It's active in classrooms and active across the world, helping the researchers catalog photographs that are being taken of wild animals in Gorongosa.
Thank you.
So it's a great, and also it was a 6-part PBS series this past fall. So if you can catch that, you'll see a lot of natural history of Gorongosa. But I do not get a commission on anyone that decides to go to Gorongosa. It's really, if this works, and it's not going to take a whole lot of tourists to make this really work economically for Mozambique. It also looks like Gorongosa is going to expand in the coming years. It's gone so well that they're now thinking of expanding the park all the way to the Indian Ocean, which is going to create a habitat pretty much the size of the Serengeti.
There are other examples of private reserves that have been successful with the black rhino.
Yeah,
and other.
Yeah, and actually this is also rhino habitat,
so they could
use it for rhinos. So the Mozambique, this is a partnership between the Carr Foundation and the Mozambican government, and cross your fingers. There are places in Africa that are going in the right direction.
Yeah, great. Couple interesting questions here about the virus and the cattle to the wildebeest. Someone asks, how did the immunity spread from cattle to wildebeest? My guess is what happened was once the cattle were immunized, they no longer transmitted.
That's right. So the virus doesn't...
Is there a natural immunity?
No, the virus doesn't hang out. So reservoirs are animals that can sustain the virus infection and be sort of a cryptic reservoir. And it doesn't do that in wildebeest and buffalo. It does it in the cattle. So once the cattle start to become immunized and sort of, if you've heard the term herd immunity... This is exactly how it works. Get a high percentage of the cattle immunized, and the virus has no place to take hold. And it couldn't hide out in the wildebeest, any unvaccinated wildebeest and buffalo. So the wildebeest, within a few years, had the benefit of no infected cattle roaming amongst them.
You may have mentioned this, but how was it introduced initially?
The virus came from India. I think it came in from India through Ethiopia in about 1889, something like that. You know, as people move around the world, they bring their domesticated stock, and in this case, they brought their diseases with them.
Great. A question here about native ecosystems such as the Serengeti or California, North America, before and after European settlement. How do you define, this is a great question, a baseline goal for recovery, since we perhaps weren't here at that point and certainly didn't document it.
I only know this from the modest number of ecologists that have been generous with their time with me the last few years. I think it's very situational. In Yellowstone, Liz Hadley up at Stanford had documented from the fossil record all the animals we knew about that were here before European settlement. And the only thing missing from Yellowstone was the wolf. So we knew that all the other mammals were there. In Yellowstone, was a refuge that saved the American bison. So that baseline was, you're short one animal. It's the apex predator, the wolf.
Right.
There you go. There's your baseline. In other cases, because these things are so interactive, take a fishery. I mean, the ocean is a fish-eat-fish world, right? Lots of species, very complex food webs. Once we've been in there fishing for a while, I don't think we're going to go back to pre-settlement times in terms of the way the relative proportion of things are in the ocean. So honestly, I think what we're going to do is we're going to look at it from a human perspective. And since we are now managing these things, regulating these things, is to say, we want to regulate them in a way that the fish stocks are sustainable for our purposes, right? We're dependent upon the ocean for a lot of protein. So we don't want the apex predators to crash. We don't want the sardines to be all gone.
Right.
We have to know enough about the biology of not just the commercial creatures, but the other ones that interact with them, because there's a lot of fish that we don't want to eat, but they're part of the system, and we don't want to screw those populations up. You probably all know that one of the important populations that we've messed up with industrial fishing is sharks across the world. Some of this is due to shark finning, but most of it's due to bycatch, catching sharks along with other things that we care to eat, and we've decimated many species of sharks to dangerous levels across the world. And, why should we worry? I don't know. They've only been the apex predators for 400 million years. What could go wrong?
So... So returning to your point about introducing species or restoring species, we now have the wolf in California. It's OR7. You probably have watched it. You can actually go online, and it's radio tagged, and you can watch it. It came from Oregon down into California. It went back to Oregon to look for a mate, and they're back now in California and apparently have a litter. A lot of debate over, is this a species we want returned to its natural levels? And also, of course, the California grizzly, which is on our state flag but is no longer in California. Will we ever see, is it possible to bring these populations back?
I think Yellowstone's the example of that. I think if there's the habitat for them. And the wolf, look, I'm not a rancher. I didn't grow up in that lifestyle. So, mm-hmm. I haven't lived that experience. But, look at the statistics. And this was... There was 20 years of public comment before Yellowstone wolves came back to Yellowstone. And there was all sorts of studies made predicting what would be the impact on livestock in the surrounding area. Because, of course, the wolves don't respect park boundaries. They don't come up to the gate and go, okay, back in. The take by wolves in terms of livestock is trivial. Trivial compared to all sorts of, car accidents and all sorts of other things that happen. That take livestock. And, there's either compensation mechanisms that can be set up or things like that. But really, I know that an individual ranch could get hard hit, and, that could be, terrible to see 10 or 20 sheep taken or something like that and traumatic, and I do feel bad that that can happen. But in general, the economic impact of the wolves on livestock is tiny compared to the ecological impact in the park and the tourist factor, which is a lot of people are thrilled to see wolves and packs of wolves in Yellowstone. So, there's got to be some discussion among various, stakeholders of what happened, but there's a lot of resistance before it's done, right? A lot of people worrying, well, what could happen? But, the more we experiment with this, the more we can learn and then say, okay, well, what were lessons learned from Yellowstone in the case of wolves and bears and take our shot. But, coyotes and, have a really important role, and wolves influence coyotes a lot. Right. And, the whole sort of predator chain is very important here in California. And, there's a lot of effects, cascading effects of the way we have managed predators.
Fully understand.
Yeah. Well, because we persecuted large predators generally anywhere we found them. And
there's a question here about a species that's, the trend lines are going the other direction, and that's frogs. Yeah. Wondered if you could address that.
Yeah, the amphibians in general and frogs in particular. Mm-hmm. And, there's a combination of things going on. I saw this in Yellowstone myself. There's this fungus, this chytrid fungus that's hitting amphibians and hitting frogs. And I don't know how many different combinations of factors frogs are putting up with, but certainly something that's happening to amphibian populations is that certain pathogens, some fungi, some parasites, are getting into North American amphibian populations from imports, either through the pet trade or through other ways. And that's one thing we really got to be worried about, is that when populations get exposed to pathogens they've never seen before, there could be essentially a pandemic through those populations that could wipe them out before we're alert to it. You may know you've heard about bats, right? This white nose bat problem. So, or colony collapse disorder in bees. These things of pretty large scale population collapses that we're trying to get at the root and trying to understand either what we've done to trigger them or what we could do to reverse them. And because these things play important either economic or ecological roles or both, we've got a lot of motivation to try to figure it out.
All right. Thank you. Someone makes the point, and it's a good one. I'd argue that we don't know all the rules, only some of them, and just enough to be dangerous. How do we move forward effectively with imperfect knowledge? And then a related question, that is, if we have less suitable habitat for other species, how do we move forward?
Well, let me take the first one about imperfect knowledge,
because
that's always going to be the case in science. It's the case in medicine. Basically, what's the big advance in ecology probably for the last 50 years is it's become a more experimental science, and that means you can conduct experiments, sometimes on a smaller, sometimes on a little bit larger scale, and test your ideas, and you maybe have a chance of getting it right in the real world. But that's just the nature of where science is at, and you hope that you know, you're not going to do something that's going to be catastrophic in the other direction. You all know stories from earlier days where we did things without any experimentation. You know, the cane toad in Australia is the poster child of, you know, a tragic situation from introducing an exotic species. You know, there were agricultural intentions that, you know, almost made sense for the cane toad, not quite in detail, but, you know, it's run amok. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we run that risk of not having all the knowledge, but I think doing nothing is, you know, basically a lot of these stories we're talking about, where doing nothing was not an option. So you feel like you have to do something, and you hope, you know, you're going to do more good than harm, but you are perhaps going to have some surprises.
Right.
And you said when the habitat is less than ideal. Again, that's sort of part of the situation you're going to have to assess, of, you know, what can you do to bring things back? And I want to be, you know, clear here, and I try to balance these things in the book. You know, while I've talked about places like Serengeti and Gorongosa, you know, pretty places, this is really about making, you know, our ecosystems functional, productive. I just, at the most pragmatic level, and I think this is where the discussion can take place, we need ecosystems to supply what we demand. So wherever you are philosophically on that question, there's just the practical question of 7.4 billion humans have demands that need to be supplied. And if we don't manage these places with the supply chain in mind, which is often understanding these food chains, then, you know, we run the risk of collapse. And collapse meaning, you know, beyond a point of no return. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be really tough in fisheries and things around the world.
Glad you mentioned that.
She's trying to stop me.
No, thank you. That actually is a beautiful segue into our next several questions. Is there a keystone species, or what is a keystone species for humans? And what do we do about the lack of regulation of the human population?
Yeah. Anyone can take a shot at that question. I often think about, okay, if you visited this planet from somewhere else and you were a zoologist from another planet and you landed, you know, you came here and you said, wow, a lot of these two-legged things and man, do they eat. Some of us more than others. Okay, so there's 7.4 billion of us now. There was 2 billion at the turn of the 20th century. There's 1 billion at the turn of the 19th century. You know, in terms of biomass, there's just a lot of humans and with a big ecological footprint. And we just have to recognize that, right? That's the way it is. Now, we could decide.
Do we know what the carrying capacity is of the Earth?
Well, there's a lot of stabs at that. Uh-huh. You know, people are worried. I mean, there's been earlier estimates that were short because there are 7.4 billion, which is more than some people thought could survive. You know, every extra billion is making us more worried, and you're wondering about quality and quantity of life in parts of the world where ecosystems are degraded or there's less food per capita and things like that. So we are our own regulators. This is it. It's up here of whether, you know, we are can have enough foresight and enough discipline to manage resources to supply ourselves. And it's a very patchy picture across the world. While, you know, headlines and no offense to the journalistic profession. Headlines come usually from trouble, like Flint, Michigan, you know, oh my gosh. You know, in the U.S., for example, our fisheries, I give them a pretty decent report card. The last 20 years' effort to manage Atlantic and Pacific fisheries. Go to the Mediterranean, developed world, EU, 28 countries around the table. Bad news. 96% of fish stocks depleted. So governance is tricky.
But we know how to do it.
We know how to do it. Yes, exactly. Right. We know what needs to be done, whether we can persuade others to do what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. So it's a patchy situation. And if you ask me to look into the crystal ball at a world with 9 or 10 billion people, I think that what you're going to see is patchy sustainability and patchy catastrophe. You know, famine and, you know, societal meltdown in some places, while other places are riding it out. I think that's the way it looks, because to have the infrastructure, the know-how to deal with a booming population when you don't have the infrastructure, that's going to be really tough.
And education plays a large role as well.
Huge role. And look at
someone poses the question of teaching evolution. I know you take a lot of pride in science education. Do you see increasing science literacy in America, or does that worry you?
Well, it worried me enough to get out of the lab and take a day job in Washington. With Hughes is the largest private supporter of science education in the U.S., so they gave me the keys to the car, and they gave me the checkbook, which was even more important. So, again, I think it's scientists by nature that we are optimistic. We are selected for our personalities, which are delayed gratification, optimism. If we just work at it, we can make it. But statistically, if you look, 18 to 30-year-old adults in this country are very different than the over 65 generation in attitudes about science.
In what sense?
Well, a 20% higher rate of acceptance of evolution.
Okay.
So I see the country going from 45 to 50% acceptance of evolution to 70 in another generation. You might like it to be higher. I would, as an evolutionary biologist. But I think 70 might be an asymptote for a while. But nonetheless, I think that makes it harder for the 30% to cause trouble. And I think they're much more ecologically in tune. Their acceptance of climate change being a serious issue, same thing, 20 points higher than older generations. And we know civil rights, all sorts of societal change, is reflected earlier and more broadly in younger generations than older generations. So some of this is time. But I think this is why I love being an educator, is I really think that, and I'm also a parent of kids in that age group, so I'm optimistic based on their attitudes.
Thank you. And the time for a final question, and this follows up on your optimism. There are lessons that we've learned, and I think you mentioned in your book, global efforts are possible, collaborations possible, coalitions are possible. We saw the eradication of smallpox, and we've seen other successes. So just to wrap up.
Well, if you give me the smallpox shot, let me take it for, and certainly anybody under 50 in the room. 50 years ago, the World Health Organization met, and this is this spring, and it was proposed to go after the eradication of smallpox. It took 3 rounds of voting to allocate $2.4 million to the effort. And then they put an American in charge, figuring that once it failed, they could blame the U.S. and not the WHO. Okay? True story. 11 years later, smallpox was eradicated from the planet. Okay? The first human disease to be eradicated from the planet. It killed more people than both world wars combined in the 20th century. So the economic cost of smallpox was huge. Now we don't, we haven't vaccinated for smallpox for 40 years. We had to go into 55 countries, tens of thousands of villages to eradicate it. And it involved governments that didn't cooperate on any other field of human endeavor. They weren't even members of the World Health Organization for this to happen. So it was a remarkable global effort by small number of people, governmentally speaking, legions of people within individual countries that went out and volunteered and made this happen. There's only one other disease that's been eradicated from the planet. Same effort, Rinderpest. Decades later, it rebounded in various parts of the world. It's a really serious disease. You can imagine catastrophic upon people who depend upon, cattle. Same approach, Rinderpest has been eradicated. I look at those two examples and I think, that involves such international cooperation, recognizing a common goal, a common interest, and the people who have been part of that, their memoirs are worth reading because I think they hold, the sort of wisdom we need for tackling the ecological challenges that are facing us.
Thank you, Dr. Carroll. You've brought us full circle here. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you very
much. Thanks a lot. Thank you, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, and by Wonderfest. Again, we would like to thank Sean Carroll, author of The Serengeti Rules, The Quest to Discover How Life Works and Why It Matters, a book that will be available out in the lobby, and Professor Carroll will sign it, I believe. We'd like to thank also Lisa Krieger of San Jose Mercury News, great science reporter, and thank all of you for joining us. And now, this event, and it's a sort of a meeting, is formally adjourned.